Hello listeners, and welcome to the AfriWrit platform, where we look to celebrate African history, people and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibuni to any new listeners to the AfriWrit world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWrit episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we are back in the south of our continent for part two as we journey to meet the fascinating kingdom of Eswatini. A shout out to my South Africans out there. AfriWrit has landed on your borders. I apologize in advance for the mispronunciation of words that will most definitely happen.
Mosetsana o tshwara ka lebante teke.
Teke la musimani. Mosetsana
o tshwara. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWrit across all of them. And here we post interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further study for all you lovely people. And also remember to tell your friends and families about us, yes? But for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. Welcome back, AfriWatu. We're back to this dope kingdom of Eswatini. So in the intro the last time, we heard about the name change of this historical kingdom from Swaziland to Eswatini. Swaziland is essentially the anglicized version of the kingdom, and in a bid to throw off the colonial shackles, Ngwenyama Mswati III, on the Independence Day in April 2018, made the decision to have a name that was one that reflected his people. That, though, is not the best thing about this kingdom, as we saw in part one, which I'm sure all of you tuned into, right? I'm speaking to those of you in the back. I see you. But it's okay. If you haven't, AfriWetu is not about judgment. It's all about knowledge. So, because of that, and for those of you who have yet to listen to part one, I'm going to do a really, really, really short recap. Think of it as the miniest of previews, just so I don't spoil it for you. Remember, though, you can listen to this and then go back, so don't stress. In part one, we covered the origins of the kingdom of Eswatini, the ancestors from Dlamini to his lineage who migrated to what is now modern Eswatini. We heard about their departure from the Nguni language kinfolk, from their arrival from the northeast, with Mozambique being the last major location before they finally settled to where they are today. We then saw the expansion of the kingdom and understood that this was a trend that started with the founder Dlamini, and that the mantle was carried from him to Ngwane and then to Mswati II, these three setting the foundation of the kingdom through conquest and concession. We met the royals, got to understand the key role noble women played in that arena, and heard about the most influential women of them, the Ndlovukati, Queen Mother. I think there that's about enough to pique your interest and curiosity to go and hear more, so I'll leave you to go and do that, okay? In today's episode, we will look at how the kingdom of Eswatini was governed, swing by to meet the people and society, weave in the military, which is closely linked to these two sections, and then the demise. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's just check where we are on our continent today. As AfriWrit said last time, the pre-colonial kingdom's territory has a very close resemblance to its modern location, albeit smaller than the actual area it spans today. The kingdom stretched from the Tembe River near Maputo in Mozambique, the Pongola River, backing back up, passing through Mahamba up to Zobudza and up to Koho up north. I do hope that your maps are open when I describe these. If not, please go back and listen again. So now let's dive into the governance of the territory, cool? We can start by digging and understanding the Ngwenyama's power. The central government's nucleus was the institution of the throne, with the Ngwenyama, who for starters had to be from the Dlamini clan and lineage, and he was then considered the supreme ruler with a firm grip on the kingdom through his control of the army, the law, and the great wealth. Basically, he was the focus and ultimate power of authority. He held great power over his subjects because he was also the head of the judiciary and the executive, and even down to control of the economy. An example of the latter was seen through his land matters, where he would be the one who had a say in land distribution as well as determining the price of that land. In the daily administration of the kingdom, there were two key national councils that played major roles. The first was the Ligogo, which is essentially like a privy council, and the second was the Libandla, which was the general council. And here we see how influential his family really was, keeping his loyal, close male blood relatives in positions of authority across the kingdom. In the Ligogo, for example, which is a smaller council, this actually had a lot of power over kingdom matters, usually consisted of the Ngwenyama's appointees from the royal family. The larger council, the Libandla, consisted of Ligogo members as well as non-royal men. They would get the Ligogo's decisions on matters of national importance and then deliberate on what to do next. Although they were still under his authority, both councils had the power to criticize, and in fact, the Ligogo even had the power to fine the Ngwenyama when he went outside the law. So between them, they were very, very influential. The kingdom itself was split into units, with each unit having its own local council and an Induna as the legal and political representative leader. Which leads us to the next level down from the councils, being these in the local administrative ranks, which consisted of local councillors, Indunas, chiefs, as well as princes and princesses from the noble houses. Similar to the royal court setup, the leader co-ruled with his mother and had a Ligogo council that consisted of men from his own patrilineal side. They would handle matters relating to the royal cattle, they adjudicated over private disputes, read cases on issues that could affect the kingdom, which they would then analyze and report their findings to the royal court. But they weren't mere pawns, they too had enough political clout to push back on the Ngwenyama if he overstepped his authority under customary law. So, the king was still mindful and careful to keep them on side. Oh, and a fun fact before we leave the governance section. In modern-day Eswatini, there are actually two main capitals, Mbabane, which is the administrative and judicial capital, and Lubamba, which is the legislative capital. Now that we kind of have a feel of the governance, let's move into the governed. So let's first understand that the people we're talking about in this section, the Mswati. So the population was a mix of different peoples and clans, and the term Swati actually originated from Mswati II, the descendant of the Mbunguni of the brother Delami, who we met in part one of this kingdom. This mix of people in society was as a result of migration to what became the final destination. Either by choice or conquest, different clans were absorbed, intermarried with, or otherwise assimilated into the society. And now, before we go deeper, I just wanted us to take a step back and link to the structure of the royal homes and understand a little bit more about the royal women's significance. We heard a bit about these in part one. The Ngwenyama and the Ndlovukati did not live in the same residence. She had her, get this, own village, which was seen as the kingdom's religious and ceremonial center. The Ndlovukati's court was her base of operations and was second only to her royal son, the Ngwenyama's. Her village had a functioning court and also housed a fully fledged military. She was a custodian of ceremonial and cultural items, and it was she also had administrative power. Her role was seen to be the moderate, who would then provide a balance to the ruler of the kingdom. This influence over political decisions could be seen when the National Council needed to get the sovereign to agree to a particular course of action. They would actually go to her to lobby her to convince them of their position, and for her to then go and convince him of their position and the steps that they would like to be taken. And because she always kept a finger on the pulse and was abreast of all the court activities and intrigues, nothing really passed her. I truly expect that by the time the petitioners went to lobby her, she already had all the necessary information. She was also informed of all the local and international affairs that impacted the kingdom. Her role's involvement wasn't merely out of curiosity, but practically, because also Her residence was known to house her son's political opponents and shield them from execution. I mean, that's a bit hardcore, no? The kingdom itself comprised of royal settlements across its territories, each with their own local chiefs. These chiefs, similar to the Ngonyama, also would have their own smaller villages within their territories where they would place their mothers as the Umphakatsi, which is the village head. So very similar to the Ndovulukati, but on a much smaller scale. And then when we go back to the way in which the villages were planned and organized, it also gives us an insight into the Swati social structure. Starting from the center and fanning outwards, in the middle, you would find the chief's residence. It was strategically placed there to be surrounded by the rest of the village and army barracks, keeping it well shielded from attacks. The idea being that by the time the enemy was at the gates, it would have had to go through very many different layers of people and housing and army in order to get to the leadership, which by that time could have either escaped or at least gathered their troops ready to fight. Where one's home was, like physically, denoted their relationship with the head of the village or the settlement. So for instance, the wives of the leader would have specially designated homes which would be closest to their husband. However, in the kingdom's capital, the layout was much the same, but on a much larger scale. And on a much, as you can imagine, larger compound, which itself housed a number of homes around the Ngonyama's great house, the Inlunkulu. In the case of the Ngonyama, only his two main wives, who came from specific identified clans, would actually live in the capital with designated housing. They were custodians of the Kabayete, the national shrine, which housed the sacred articles and ritual objects of the kingdom and was used for ancestral communications. The other wives were then dispersed throughout the kingdom. Back in the villages, the senior members of the community would also build their houses surrounding the main house in a circular formation, and these officials were usually kinfolk of the chief. The rest of the population would then be further fanned out from the center of their homes, providing, as I said, a line of defense. In all of these villages, there'd be a Libutvo, which meant a regiment, who would be stationed there to provide protection from attacks. Their barracks were set up right at the front of the main house, placed in this way so as to respond quickly and effectively to any attacks and protect their people without hindrance. And speaking of regiments and such, now is a good intro to the next section, military. So let's start by acknowledging that the military was fierce. I mean, starting from their days of fighting off their powerful neighboring civilizations such as the Zulu, they were not a pushover and could actually hold their own. The role of the military in the kingdom was both as a military of conquest and battles and such like, but it was also an integral part of the kingdom's governance structure and its strength and was linked to society. So much so that between the military and civilian sectors, those lines weren't even blurred. It was like just one continuous flow. This was seen from something as fundamental as the kingdom's administration. Those who held roles as part of the civilian authority were attached to an army unit or regiment. The kingdom had a clear hierarchical structure in which the military played a major part in this and local politics. The Ngonyama had the ultimate final say as the head of the military. So, for example, only he could constitute new regiments, and these would then be designated a unique identity, which is distinguished by a unique name, insignia, platoon, and each had their own unique command calls and signals. An interesting fact as well within this military, as is the case in most African cultures, respect for elders is paramount. And here we see this in the role of the elder and retired soldier. The kingdom had a practice known in Eswati as in Holonipo, and here the Ngonyama understood the importance of the elders in the community and would appoint an Umutu Lomlaza from the older generation who would act as a guide for these younger recruits. Then when it came to the structure, under the Ngonyama sat two principals, both of whom were royal appointees. The first was the Umtuane Nkosi, which is a prince, and then the second one was the Induna Yemabutu, the commander-in-chief, who was not a noble. This commander-in-chief was actually actively led the military campaigns and was in charge of their upkeep during such missions. They were considered loyalists to the monarchy, and this combined with the military knowledge meant that they were very, very well respected. Other important leadership roles included the Itilmo, which, fun fact, it derives from the word umlomo, which means a mouth, which is very similar to the Swahili word for mouth, mdomo. Just thought I'd throw that in there. Anyway, the Itilomo were men who were selected and their status elevated in recognition for their service to the kingdom. They acted as senior military advisors and were consulted on matters concerning all the army. A lot of emphasis was placed on strength and skilled fighting as well as military strategy. Those soldiers who had shone would get a chance to reenact their victory to a crowd. There was also room to celebrate and honor those who had died in service for their kingdom. I read an interesting thing about what happens when that is the case. In fact, so on the news of the dead soldier's relatives would then offer an animal or equivalent to it to the courts. And then the Ngwenyama would use it to perform a special ceremonial cleansing ritual. But back to the regiments. So they bonded and became very loyal to each other over their clans and kinsmen. And if you can imagine that some joined the army as really young preteens, then truly they would have created lifelong bonds. The soldiers, like was expected, fought not just with spears, but were fierce in hand-to-hand combat using the assegai, the short stabbing spear. And in fact, if you came home without it, woe unto you, the shame of coming back without your weaponry. Speaking of that, when the military actually came back from their campaigns, all the booty was then handed to the Ngwenyama, who, after deducting the kingdom's share, distributed it based on the performance of a regiment and rewarded those soldiers who had excelled. I mean, people, KPIs were clearly not that new. Soldiers and their regiments would then claim bragging rights when they outshone their brothers in arms during battle, always looking to outdo each other. They would goad the others, who in response would then request that they were allowed to go out and prove that they were the better soldiers, beating the others by bringing back the booty, which is usually cattle, and then so they could boast of their own courage and loyalty to the throne. Then there were the certain regiments that were the chosen ones, favored by the Ngwenyama. These tended to be his royal regiments, who were stationed at royal villages. During battle, they would be at the front line, leading the armies into the breach, wearing their very distinctive beaded necklaces that reflected their special status. They were basically the elite forces, who for their bravery and special skills, they also enjoyed special perks like tax and clothing allowances. And then even within this category of special people, there were those who were even more special. The Umfana Wenkosi, the king's couriers. They would then have an animal slaughtered in their honor in every village they traveled to. The perks of being in the military could also on occasion find one's own lobola, which is dowry, paid for them. And although the relationships between men and women were highly regulated, sexual acts were not. The soldiers' peers would carry the responsibility of ensuring that the betrothed remained loyal to their pal, including amongst themselves. In fact, it was considered shameful to seduce your friend's woman. There were instances where they would give her food and shelter in his absence as part of their duties, as well as just monitoring her. Yep, I said it, monitoring her. Whilst on this topic of lobolo, the approval to get married and have children was done as a blanket permission granted by the Ngwenyama for a particular age set. And when the youngest age set was granted this permission and it was declared, then traditionally there was a formation of the new soldier sets. This announcement was usually done during the Inswala, which is the annual first fruit festival, or when there was a general council meeting. At this announcement, all the young boys were to sign up and they didn't need their father's permission to join the army. Actually, it was expected that all the boys and men would become part of a regiment. Liptuvo. On joining, they would then be assigned to an existing Liptuvo, almost like an apprenticeship, and here they would learn the ropes. From their youth, boys were groomed to become soldiers, with discipline starting from under 10 when they attended to small animal herds, then graduating to look after larger livestock. They would also be expected to explore the terrain and understand the flora and fauna, as well as learn how to survive in the bush independently. These boys would then grow up and share experiences in their journey to manhood with their peers as part of their social groups. Thus, even when they joined and became soldiers, this aspect of their lives continued, as the military wasn't just focused on fighting, they were considered to be part and parcel of civilian life, society, politics, and even legal matters. Soldiers took part in traditions and legal processes as witnesses, students, and participants. They were encouraged to be a part of the community, and in their downtime were deployed to carry out labor-intensive work around the kingdom, usually agricultural work such as planting, plowing, harvesting, and so on. They also helped in other manual labor such as construction of houses, fences, and such like. And here we are at the demise of this kingdom. So what happened? I hear you ask. Well, if you were with us in part one, you'll remember how precarious things were, and this kingdom suffered from the internal wrangling of the royals, especially when it came to succession. These conflicts in time proved to be a core reason for the kingdom's demise. Now, upon the death of Mbandazeni in 1889, the resulting purge of those who were thought to have betrayed the dead monarch marked the final blow to the kingdom. Factions emerged and staked their loyalties to the opposing sides, each one accusing the other of offenses towards the kingdom, and each one backing one of the prominent noble women, the old queen and the reigning Ndlovukati Gwamile Mduli Labotsibeni. The latter was vehemently anti-foreigner, as well as gunning for her own son's ascent to the throne. But before we venture deeper, some context as to the rot. It had actually started during Swati II's reign, when the foreigners had begun their invasion on the land. In order to manage them and keep the core of his kingdom intact, Mswati hived off some of his kingdom and let them live there. This tactic worked for a time and was replicated by his descendant, Mbandazeni, who then thought it was better to grant some land in order to keep the foreigners at bay. Mbandazeni then had already witnessed devastation, had seen the illegal land grabbing and the theft from other African civilizations by the foreigners, and so calculated that granting land was a better option to then protect his own kingdom from the same fate. He was acutely aware of the threat and is quoted as saying, "I have white men all around me. By force, they have taken the countries of all my neighbors. If I do not give them rights here, they will take them. Therefore, I will give when they pay. Why should we not eat before we die?" He was wrong as in totally underestimating the greed and the cruel mentality that he was facing. So now we're here, let's go back to the aftermath of his death and the factions we spoke of. One of them was the older queen's faction, which was led by Mdolo Mafisha Namkumbule and comprised of the council of chiefs who were loyal to her. They were on friendly terms with the foreigners, so much so that they even want to reinstate one of these foreigners as an advisor to the court. The other faction, loyal to Ndlovukati Gwamile, called these actions suspicious and claimed a conspiracy was afoot to hand the kingdom over to the white man, giving away their sovereignty. Her point was strengthened by the fact that the same foreign advisor was proven to have forged signatures of the Swati authorities on a major treaty which was misleading along the partition of the lands. Talk about high level corruption, people. So going back to the root and the rot, if you actually read between the lines though, it was really a fight between two very powerful women. And the royal family was just one at the core and at odds. The society was torn and weakened by the leaders' actions and division. Ultimately and unfortunately, all had underestimated the brutal colonial purpose of the foreigners' minds, and as they were being divided, it was easy for them to be eventually conquered. Ndlovukati did prevail, and her son Mbuni did become the last true military Ngwenyama, And it was during his reign that the resistance, which was spearheaded by his mother, was at its strongest. This spirit of fierce independence was carried on after his death by the two main figures as a people's champions against the cruel colonial wave, namely his mother Ndluvukati Gwamile, who rules the kingdom on his death, and on hers, King Sobhuza II. So, what else was going on in the world as our Eswatini kingdom was thriving and to its demise? In 1626, St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican was completed. 1770 to 1771, the famine in the Czech lands killed hundreds of thousands. In 1793, the largest yellow fever epidemic in American history killed as many as 5,000 people in Philadelphia. In 1816, Shaka rises to power over the Zulu Kingdom. In 1857, the Indians mutiny against the British. In 1804, the world population reaches 1 billion people. And in 1820, Liberia is founded by the American Colonization Society for Freed American Slaves. So as we bring it home, I want to leave you all with two quotes. The first is this, by Hamilton Sifo Simeleni. Most Swazi historians have tended to concentrate on British and Boer imperialistic intrigues in Swaziland. The rivalry between Boer and British interests always emerge as a driving engine of historical events. From such an approach, at best, the Swazi emerge as passive actors, and at worst, as pawns in the chessboard of British and Boer imperialism. There is no doubt that the pressure of Boer expansionism, combined with the pressure to safeguard perceived British interests, negated Swazi efforts to safeguard their independence. There is, however, the necessity of analyzing the manner in which the Swazi contributed in shaping their own history. Present-day Swaziland is not only a product of colonialism, but also a reflection of Swazi responses to the forces of change which engulfed the whole African continent. So when I read this, it really captured how I felt and approached the history of the Kingdom of Eswatini, coming in with a little knowledge bar the very colonial Eurocentric version that prevails, reducing it to fit a narrative that is not ours. Personally, I enjoyed this history as it was not only all brand new, but also showed yet again how diverse and fascinating our story is, and it still resonates to this day, as well as how important it is for us to capture our narrative. And for the second and last quote, this is from the fierce Ndluvukati Gwamile. We are Swazis. We Swazis are proud people. And the Swazis will keep their independence under Labutsibeni, the wise she-elephant. That is me. Against Ningwane, against Shaka, against the Boers, against the English, the Swazis shall not be conquered. And indeed, ultimately, the kingdom remains. So with that, until next time, Ubariki.